Our next guest says that the argument over relief for the victims of Sandy is important, but it obscures a bigger discussion that Congress should be having about revamping federal relief efforts. Juliette Kayyem is national security and foreign policy columnist for the Boston Globe, and she serves on the faculty at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. She was also Assistant Secretary for Intergovernmental Affairs at the Department of Homeland Security under President Obama, and she joins me in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Well, let's talk mainly about foreign policy today, but first we're going to start with something a little bit closer to home, and that's the federal relief for victims of Hurricane Sandy. You say that those victims should be given financial assistance, but Congress should also be talking about future aid. Why and what should that conversation be about?
Right now, everyone expected the system to work, which was be that there would be relief for the victims of Sandy, and we have a proposal by the Senate at $60 billion. The House appropriations came back with 20, we figure there'll be a compromise. And then as we saw what happened, it sort of fell apart when the House tabled the vote. It's likely to come back as early as Friday. But it obscures and probably delays an important debate we should be having, which is percolating through the sort of emergency management and disaster management circles, which is whether our relief, disaster relief system shouldn't be revamped in an age of superstorms and climate change. We're just seeing more disaster declarations, much more expensive, both flood insurance as well as just the traditional Stafford Act, which is how FEMA pays for it. And so some of the proposals on the table, which are worth considering, are whether we shouldn't rethink how disaster management money flows to states and localities, whether we shouldn't put conditions on them. Why are we allowing cities and states to rebuild exactly as it was, knowing that they're going to be vulnerable? Why do we pay people who build close to oceans without the appropriate insurance or seawalls? And so whether we shouldn't use aid as a carrot and a stick. That's not Democrat, Republican. Those are people who are experts in disaster management are now starting to think, you know, the system we've had for 50 years is good, it worked, but this is a whole new world now.
But does it encourage people to be careless, really?
Right. Yeah. It does, and to the extent that you can view disaster relief as sort of being able to drive a particular kind of behavior, not just by individuals, but by cities and states and localities, we ought to be thinking about that. That debate is now completely sidelined because everyone wants, rightfully, their Sandy money. And we'll see what the number is going to be. It's probably be close to $40 billion, my guess is. Mm.
Let's move to international issues and some of the things that the presumed next Secretary of State, Senator John Kerry, might be facing. And let's talk about Pakistan first. There was just another drone strike there near the Afghan border. The war in Afghanistan continues,
yes.
Even though the U.S. is supposed to be pulling out. But Kerry has worked in that part of the world.
Right.
And so when he looks at issues in Pakistan and Afghanistan, what does he bring to the table that might change things as the U.S. looks at this as in terms of foreign policy?
Well, I think what he adds is consistency, which is probably a good thing in both Afghanistan and Pakistan. Starting with Afghanistan, there's now a proposal on the table for what our legacy troop involvement will be after the sort of formal withdrawal in at the end of next year. So it's still a couple years away. Are we going to leave 6,000 troops, which would essentially be a counterterrorism effort, up to, I think, one of the proposals on the table for the White House is 14,000. So that proposal, which has been brought to the White House from the Defense Department, will be something that if Kerry's confirmed quickly, he'll need to review. And the sense is that we'll probably keep a limited number of troops in Afghanistan related to counterterrorism efforts because we don't want to see the rise of the Taliban or Al-Qaeda again. On Pakistan, he brings to the table, I think, extensive relationships, not just with the political leadership, which is a difficult political leadership, one could say, but also the military leadership, which is so important in Pakistan. I don't think you're going to see major changes with the use of drones. They are desired by the Pakistan government for a variety of reasons. And a court yesterday, approved the use of drones by the Obama administration, or at least said that they didn't have to release a legal memorandum. So I think that there's going to be consistency as we draw down the troop involvement in Afghanistan, and where you won't see such tremendous changes as you might in other areas that Kerry will oversee.
So stability.
Stability is a good thing. There's no drama in that part of the world is a good thing. And there's always going to be the India issue as relates to Pakistan. India is having its own problems right now as people have been following this rape case, which is just horrible. But I think what's happening in India is what you're seeing. What we tend to forget when we look at foreign policy, I guess I should say, is that there's also domestic politics in these countries. What's happening in India is likely to be the focus of India for a while, which is just domestic unrest in a nation that has grown so quickly, but does not have the infrastructure, whether it's safety and security for women, or as we saw this year with the blackout in India, which affected a billion people. We're not the only country that tends to look inward these days, or these other countries have tremendous problems themselves.
Mm-hmm. Of course, we did just hear, though, that there will be five people charged in that rape
yes.
in India.
Yeah, I think that today that is happening, and the groundswell of shock and rage is clearly the tip of an iceberg of a systemic problem in India as relates to the civic awakening of women in political and business life, and the fact that they don't feel safe and secure on the streets is going to be a major issue for them.
Mm-hmm. One place where there is drama continuing almost daily, Syria.
Yes.
We just heard about a horrific strike at a gas station right outside of Damascus. Is the crisis in Syria, would you say, reaching a tipping point right now, or how would you describe it?
I would not. We've been calling it a tipping point for over a year now. Mm-hmm. What you're seeing, the UN also yesterday came out with, and I don't have the numbers in front of me, but just, you know, what the casualty toll is.
60,000,
right, mm-hmm. which was higher than anyone anticipated. What's happening now, you cannot call it the tipping point. It looks, every time you think Assad is at the end of the line, he seems to get his forces, pull them together and fight back, is what you're seeing in Damascus right now. And so until Russia and China move, which they're not going to do in terms of putting more pressure on Assad to leave or get a diplomatic solution, we are going to be alone in our efforts. Not alone, we have an international community supporting us, but unless we're willing to put military backing behind it, I don't think that we can say that this is the end of what's happening in Syria. Mm-hmm. You're seeing the UN envoy try to get a resolution, but neither the rebels nor Assad seems to want it. And so 9 months ago, I think I thought that we were at the end of the line, and now this is just a disastrous war with no good solutions. And the longer it takes, you know, the idea that when Assad leaves that this is going to be resolved is actually sort of a fallacy. And what we should be looking at, absent military intervention, is an inevitable or more likely than not civil war in Syria in response to Assad being gone. And what positioning do we want to be in to sort of try to mute what is clearly just a very violent nation?
Juliette Kayyem is national security and foreign policy columnist for the Boston Globe. After a short break, our conversation continues with a look at Arab news giant Al Jazeera and its efforts to broaden its U.S. audience. And later in the show, the debate over publicizing information about gun owners after the Newtown massacre. Back in a minute, here and now. Welcome back to our conversation with Juliette Kayyem, national security and foreign policy columnist for the Boston Globe. She's helping us tick through some foreign policy issues facing the U.S. this year as the expected new Secretary of State, John Kerry, takes over. But I want to turn next to a question about the media and the news today that Al Jazeera is buying Current TV. Now, the first reaction that we've seen is from Time Warner Cable, which dropped Current TV from its lineup in response. And despite that, some 40 million homes in the U.S. could have access to Al Jazeera. So, Juliette Kayyem, how do you think this move fits into Al Jazeera's plans?
To understand Al Jazeera, you have to leave the United States because it is such a huge media juggernaut throughout the world. I mean, it has got 6 sports stations, a documentary station. I mean, it is a massive media enterprise, and we view it solely in the lens of the Arab Spring. It's not. It is simply a huge global media outlet. But since the Arab Spring, it has been praised. And I really think this is true for it. You know, it just has people everywhere. So if you want to find out, you know, if I asked you, you know, what's happening in Tunisia now, you would have to go to Al Jazeera to figure out what's going on in Tunisia, because we don't get that kind of coverage. They were not able to break into the market here, despite even Hillary Clinton saying that she watches it. And so they've been doing a lot of web streaming and other ways to get through the cable barrier. When I was there last month, I went there and was sort of just amazed by the campus that is Al Jazeera and in Doha. And they were hinting that there was going to be a big breakthrough. What they probably didn't anticipate was that Time Warner, 4 hours later, would say, okay, we're just going to drop all of current TV. Time Warner will claim that this has to do with commercial viability. But it's hard. I mean, given the stuff on cable right now, it's hard to imagine there isn't some audience to get Middle Eastern news from a Middle Eastern network.
But is that the stereotype of Al Jazeera?
Yes.
And of course, it's owned by a conservative monarchy.
Right.
So will it be difficult for Americans to accept it as a legitimate news source?
Yes, and I think it is, except for, you know, just a sort of 60% of their web traffic comes from the United States. It is something that anyone who cares about the field and is interested in the Middle East has to watch. Maybe some of its editorial content is further one way or the other. I don't even know how you would describe it than we are used to in United States newspapers or cable networks. But what essentially Al Jazeera is it's a global network not focused on the United States. And that shouldn't scare anyone. I mean, so it just is focused on parts of the world that we tend not to get coverage about. And so it is one of the most bizarre reactions, because I think that most people who have a visceral reaction to it don't watch it or don't look at their website. If you look at their website, you're like, oh, I didn't know that was happening in this country.
Right.
You know, that it's just more in depth. And they're, it's a young network. Their correspondents, who I met a lot of, are quite young, aggressive. They are all tend to be Western educated. They get the media. It is owned by the monarchy. The monarchy has wavered at times about how much independence Al Jazeera gets, but for the most part, it is no different than any other media conglomerate. There are always business interests that sometimes clash with the journalistic interests. And so we'll see what happens. But it sounds like this was a short-lived deal because, you know, no one really watches current TV now, as we know. But without Time Warner Cable running it, a lot fewer people will have access to it.
Okay, and before we go, let's just bring up a couple of other things about John Kerry.
Yes.
Bring him back into the conversation. As he is expected to be the next Secretary of State. So that means he leaves the Senate.
Right.
And chairmanship of the Foreign Relations Committee would go to Democratic Senator Robert Menendez of New Jersey. Now, you've said that's not an ideal thing for the White House. Why
not? It isn't. You know, I am a huge fan of John Kerry, and I think this is a great pick for Secretary of State. But you always have to look at what comes behind it. And so Menendez is great on for the Democrats and for the White House on domestic issues. And so, but he is now going to be chair of the Foreign Relations Committee. And I do believe the Republican enthusiasm, Republican Senate enthusiasm for John Kerry probably had something to do with their expectation that Menendez would take charge. He is a child of Cuban immigrants. Overtures to Cuba, which is going to be a fascinating country in 2013, are likely to not go very far. He is not a fan of loosening sanctions or extending diplomatic relations with Cuba, just at a time when Cuba is going through its own changes, is trying to change their immigration rules to allow more travel, at a time when President Obama gets close to 50% of the Cuban vote in Florida, which we tend to think of as conservative. But Menendez is of the old school. And on Iran, he is much more aggressive than John Kerry or the White House, both in terms of sanctions and then sort of hints about military strikes in terms of their nuclear arsenal. He has proposed legislation that the White House has opposed in terms of sanctions against various Iranian banks. And so that's just going to make a more interesting dynamic, ironically, for John Kerry, who's going to be the person testifying before this committee.
Another thing in terms terms of domestic fallout from foreign policy veterans.
Yes.
After the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, we have a lot of folks coming back home, and there's a lot of debate about how to care for veterans, and you've written about
this. I come back to the veterans issue a lot. I mean, one, because we tend to forget it, but also there is a lot of interesting work being done. I think, for one, everyone recognizes that the Veterans Administration needs to modernize. That is happening now, probably not fast enough. They still have long delays on claims. We need to change veteran services in terms of making them more localized, making them more personal, not making, you know, guys, you know, men and women travel 100 miles for basic dental care. It doesn't make sense anymore in this day and age. And then, of course, you know, the suicide issue, which is just, it's just systemic. It is a problem. The numbers are going up each month, and the numbers are not only greater than combat numbers now in terms of fatalities, they are mostly men and women, but mostly men who have never deployed. And that is something that the Army is trying to address, but still hasn't gotten a handle on.
Juliet Kayyem, national security and foreign policy columnist for the Boston Globe. Thanks for coming in to talk with us.
Thank you for having me.
News is next, here and now.